Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So last time I was here, the weather outside was awful. There was snow, and we had a good crowd of stalwarts who were here. And at the time, Marjorie said, well, Regina's going to be coming back on the 31st. And the topic is going to be, and I didn't have a particular topic, so I asked, so what would people like to talk about? And so, we had two suggestions. The first suggestion was the issue of homosexuality in Judaism. And then somebody else, I think having mercy on me, said, well, how about the origins of kashrut? But, I've always been a sucker for a dare. And you can't dare me to do something and not expect that I'm going to. And that leads us to today's topic, which is, as I put it on the sheet, Orthodoxy and LGBT. I'm speaking here in a conservative synagogue, but being an Orthodox rabbi, I'd rather speak about it from an Orthodox perspective rather than pretend to represent something else. It's a huge issue. It's no longer a huge issue worldwide. I shouldn't say worldwide, that's an exaggeration. But, certainly from the standpoint here in Canada, the phrase alternative lifestyle is, no longer even used. There's no such thing as alternative. There is a person does this, a person does that, and all things are basically considered equal. Within Judaism and certainly within the Orthodox community, it's still a very challenging issue to navigate. I had a friend of mine who applied for a job as a head of school. This goes back 7-8 years ago. And one of the central questions on the interview was, if you have a family that wants to send their child to kindergarten, and there are two fathers and no mother, what's your response? And that's a very significant question within the community, because it's all well and good to say, well, we accept all children, we want to give a Jewish education to all Jewish children. There will be concern from other parents. Their child goes over there to play and is exposed to this, and what's the influence going to be, and all the different questions that you can imagine. Questions come up in the synagogue. If you have somebody who is, if you have a man who's known to be living with another man, and he's going to get an aliyah, or he's going to blow shofar, or he's going to lead the davening, are those things acceptable? Comes up in a community that very much emphasizes marriage and having children, right? It is considered normal to walk up to a young man or a young woman who is, let's say in their 20s, and apparently single, and say, I know somebody, or I have a grandchild, or whatever it is, which can be really offensive if you're suggesting, you're suggesting a nice boy for a girl who's not interested. It can create embarrassment, it can create hard feelings, it creates all sorts of discomfort on every level of interaction. This is an issue. And the Orthodox community has to figure out a way to deal with it. I brought you a source here, the first source on the sheet. Does anyone have sheets? No, I don't have that. Some extras over there. Okay, thank you. This is an article, you can see the date on it, April 2001. At the time that a movie came out called Trembling Before God. How many of you saw that? Okay, a few of you. I recommend it highly. When it came out in 2001, 2002, I had to speak about it in my community at the time. And it basically consists of interviews with people who are Orthodox, that's where they identify themselves, and who are dealing with homosexuality in a variety of ways. And it talks about their experience growing up. There are interviews with some rabbis as well. Needless to say, I don't agree with everything that's said in the film. At the same time, I think it's really important in terms of getting a perspective on the experience and on what it's like within the community and some of the challenges. So if you take a look at this source from Moment Magazine, later this year, with the release of the documentary film Trembling Before God, the painful lives of gay Orthodox Jews will play out unflinchingly on movie screens nationwide. The film, which is slated to open in New York this month, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah in January. It, quote, stirred much emotion in the audience, immediate interest from buyers, according to a report in the Washington Post. putting the gay Orthodox community in an unfamiliar position, the limelight. And with this exposure comes the growing realization by gay Orthodox Jews that there are others like them out there. 5 years ago, 1996, when three gay Orthodox friends founded a support group called the Gay and Lesbian Yeshiva Day School Alumni Association. Someone give them a better acronym. It's a mouthful, yeah. Orthodox homosexuals were much more isolated. Quote, gay Orthodox people didn't exist in the eyes of the Orthodox world then, says Chaim, a New York area professional who was at the group's first meeting. If you didn't know any other gay Orthodox Jews, you carried around this really dark secret. Today, says Chaim, all of that is changing. The underground community is growing, allowing gay Orthodox Jews to associate with each other. Quote, we come from all kinds of families and all kinds of backgrounds, Chaim says. We are everywhere. Now, if you take a look at number two, you find an article that appeared in the magazine Jewish Action a couple of years later. Jewish Action is published by the Orthodox Union, the OU. And this fellow, Adam Jessel, notes one thing which he feels was missing from the film. The problem with Trembling is not so much what it shows as what it leaves out. Where are the stories of those who don't act on their homosexual attractions? Those who simply feel that sexual desire is not a license to violate a divine imperative. Aren't their struggles powerful and inspiring as well? Here again, the liberal mantra of diversity and inclusion does not apply to those who strive to adhere to the halakha, to Jewish law. And there's a real tension here, because Jessel, in source number two, is concerned that by placing an emphasis on the struggles of people who want to fit into the Orthodox community while living this lifestyle, if that's going to be discussed and elevated, then you sort of ignore the possibility of somebody who says, I have this desire, this is who I am, and yet I'm not going to pursue that lifestyle. And it's an odd phrase to use, but to a certain extent, there's a fear of over-tolerance. There's a fear of respect for others who do differently, leading to an acceptance of that as normal and the rejection of anything else. And that's what you're seeing Jessel say in number two. He's worried that if you speak about this in understanding terms and respectful terms, then the result is you discourage people from pursuing another, perhaps more traditional path. And that's the fear that he's feeling here. Now, what I'd like to do, recognizing this, I laid all this out for the last few minutes just to make it clear that these are, number one, ongoing issues. Number two, they invade the various parts of the Orthodox community and Orthodox life. I want to deal with four particular questions. Well, the first thing I want to do before the four questions is to just talk about what the sources have to say within Torah. Like, where does this come from? What's the original text from which the prohibition is drawn? That's, I think, our starting point within Torah, how basic tradition viewed homosexuality. And then once we've done that, I have four questions I want to address. Number one, why is this prohibition such a big issue? Why does this get made so much of when, after all, quite frankly, there are many other laws in Judaism that people observe or do not observe that don't get the same headlines? So that's number one. Number two, is it possible within Judaism, within Jewish thought, for there to be a test, for God to give somebody a test that they can't pass? In other words, if this is really a biological imperative, if this is the way people are born, which is certainly a strong view, not universal, but a strong view among scientists, is it possible for it to be prohibited? And then a third question, what exactly, within Orthodoxy, does God expect these people to do? If someone is born with an inclination for their own gender, that's who they are, so what exactly do you expect of them if you're telling me not to act on it? And then last, what exactly is the expectation of the Jewish community in accepting, dealing with this situation among its, in itself? So those are the four questions I want to deal with, but I have to start with the basics. And that is the stance of Jewish law on same-sex attraction. Now, as I said to Marjorie before, I'm open to being interrupted at any point, so feel free. The only thing that I would ask, if possible, is that we stick more to the ideas that are involved as opposed to a personal experience to the extent possible. I expect that, if not all, that most of us have family who are gay, whether we know it or not, quite frankly, have encountered this either in the Jewish community or in general life. I just know that I have an hour to work with and, you know, a lot to discuss. So we have to start off with a biblical text. It's probably familiar to you, source number 3. It may well be the most famous verse in Leviticus. And with a male, you shall not live as you live with a woman. It's addressed in the masculine to a male. With a male, you shall not live as you live with a woman. It is to'evah. I'm always impressed by the fact that the church is so familiar with this verse in Leviticus. I'm pretty sure the rest of Leviticus isn't really as interesting to them. Nonetheless, within Judaism, within Reform, so the answer tends to be this is a human-generated verse reflecting the era in which the Torah is written down, and it may not be binding today. At the other end of the spectrum, within Orthodoxy, there's a central tenet that says that Torah is to be viewed as divine, as the Word of God, and therefore it's just as relevant today as it was more than 3,000 years ago at Sinai. And so this is accepted as law. It's brought in the Talmud and Sanhedrin. It's brought in Maimonides' work of law. It's considered accepted law. There was no debate historically on a limitation of the verse to particular relations. I know that there's a trend in some circles to say that this is only if it's a bad relationship, but in a positive, loving relationship, the verse doesn't apply. But it's not what the verse says, and it's not the way it was ever understood historically. I should note, it does not ban homosexuality. It does not ban friendship with somebody of the same gender. What it bans is a particular sexual act. And the reason I stress that is because within Western culture, there has historically been a view that the person who has some homosexual attraction is somehow deviant, defective, less than, corrupt, you know, all the different terms that have been used over the ages, and it's just not anchored in what you're seeing in the biblical text. Yes, there is an action that is prohibited, but that's where it begins and ends. So that's in terms of males. You'll notice it doesn't say females. And in fact, biblically, there is no prohibition biblically against lesbianism. That's something that is found rabbinically. Yes?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Could you translate the last word, please?
I'm going to get there. I deliberately left that one in italicized Hebrew, and the reason for that will be clear shortly. So good question. You're on the right track. I'll need a minute to get there. But that's the basics of it. You have a biblical prohibition against a particular sexual act of a man with a man, and a rabbinic prohibition against women similarly. So we get to our first question, which is, why is this such a big issue? In general, within Judaism, even though we have a principle that says that the Torah is supposed to be observed in entirety, nonetheless, we have ways to grade prohibitions, to say that some of them are considered more severe than others, more serious than others. I can think of several different ways to grade prohibitions, but I'm curious. What would you say is a way to determine that one prohibition is to be taken more seriously than another? Yeah?
If it harms someone else, that should be...
Okay. Harms others is one answer. That something that harms others may be considered more significant. We know the Talmud states that if somebody harms other people, then you can't get forgiveness from God before Yom Kippur without first having apologized and made things right with the other party. So clearly we can take the relations with other people as more significant. Good. What else? How else would you determine that a certain prohibition, a certain law, is more serious than others?
Based on the punishment that's prescribed.
Good. So Judah says, the punishment that the Torah prescribes. Some things in the Torah have a death penalty. Granted that it's very, very difficult traditionally to actually carry out a death penalty, meaning that the Talmud is famous for saying that if a court killed once in 70 years, that was already considered excessive. It was very hard to actually carry out, but saying that it is a death penalty was a means of saying God really cares about this, more than saying you should go out and execute people. Yes?
It curbs procreation.
Well, you're dealing with this one in particular. I'm not at this particular law yet, but in general, what would you say shows that a prohibition is particularly severe? Yes?
Before we go any further,
yes?
Does science or the medical or the Torah explain how this happens?
So I'm going to get to that a little bit. So hold the question for a bit, but when I get to the question of whether you can have a test you can't pass, that's going to be part of the conversation. Sorry, there was another hand I thought I saw. Okay, then I'm going to throw in a few. Other ways to grade prohibitions as being more or less serious would include whether it is biblical or rabbinic. That which is biblical is going to generally be considered more significant. Room for exceptions, but basically so. Another one is whether the person's action is intentional or not intentional. In other words, is the sin done out of rebellion, like I reject this law? Or is the sin, I can't help it, I have a desire for something? Or is it obviously accidental would be less of a concern? Another one is whether it's a sin of commission or omission. Right? That which one violates by failing to do something is not as serious as that which one violates by actively breaking the law. So that would be another criteria. Another one is awareness. That's not really about the law, but it's about the action of violating it. Did the person realize that what they were doing was prohibited? Let's go with these. One more that's important to note for this conversation is whether it is public or private. That which is done in private would be less bad than that which is done out in public. You're familiar with the phrase Hilul Hashem?
Yes.
What does it mean?
Desecration.
Right, desecration of God's name. A public sin says to the world, I don't care about God. So that is done in private is not the same in terms of its communal impact. There was a hand. Karen?
I just wanted to know this is
Porcini's list. It doesn't come from a particular source. These are just factors which will make a particular transgression worse than another one. In other words, it's worse for me to violate a biblical law than a rabbinic law. It's worse for me to violate a law that has a stricter punishment involved than one that the Torah prescribes a lighter punishment for. It's worse for me to violate a prohibition intending to rebel. It's worse for me to violate a prohibition by commission, by acting, as opposed to just letting things go, shaved al pasa in Hebrew. It's worse for me to violate a prohibition if I'm aware that the act is prohibited. It's worse if I violate a prohibition by harming others. It's worse if I violate a prohibition publicly. Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. And working from these criteria, if two men or two women set up a family themselves, they are going to be they're going to be the parents of the children. They're going to be publicly living together. Then you end up with number one. I'm going to leave out harm to others because their argument will be it's consensual. But they're violating something which the Torah does in fact prescribe a harsh punishment. Right? The punishment that's presented in the Torah for it is death. Now, again, I know for you, as I said before, the death penalty was extremely hard to carry out. Just to give you an illustration of that. The Torah actually mandates, it commands judges in court to try to save the defendant. It's not an impartial judge. The judge is required to cross-examine the witnesses in an attempt to undermine their testimony. And in the event that an answer to a question is, I don't know, the testimony is thrown out. So to give the classic Talmudic illustration, there was a sin that was supposed to have taken place beneath a fig tree. And so the rabbi involved asks the witnesses, were the stems of the figs on this tree thick or thin? Which really has nothing to do whatsoever with the crime involved, but is an attempt to undermine the witnesses. So that if the witnesses contradict each other, one says thick and the other one says thin, or if one of them says, I wasn't paying attention to the figs, their case is thrown out. The point is not to execute people, the point is to convey a message. That's the idea. There's more to be said about that. Maybe we'll have a class on the death penalty sometime. We survived this one. But you're dealing with a biblical prohibition. You're dealing with a prohibition that is not necessarily violated with intention to reject the Torah and its law, as much as it's, this is who I am and this is what I desire, so I would not put a check mark for this one. It's a sin of commission. It involves an act. There is awareness, I think it's generally known, that this is what the biblical text says, and it's public. And so one reason why this is taken more seriously is because you have so many check marks here. You have so many elements of it that make it a more serious violation. That's one reason. But another takes us back to the very purpose of creation itself. If you look on your sheet, source number 4, this verse should look familiar. I translated it in the way that many of the classic commentators do, which I think is more grammatic with the Hebrew than the usual translation. In other words, people usually translate it, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. However, it's very clear that it's not the correct translation. Grammatically, it's in the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth was ... in the next verse. But the reason I bring this for you is because what is the very first trait we know of God? He is a creator. He is a creator of life. That's the very first thing that the Torah wants us to know about God. Sorry. If you take a look at number 5, you find the very first blessing that God gives to his creations. And God blessed them, saying, bear fruit, multiply, fill the water and the seas, etc. The very first blessing God gives in the Hebrew is pru uruvu, pru from the word pri, perot, bear fruit and multiply. Source number 6, the very first command that God gives humanity, even before don't eat from the fruit, which famously did not work well. The very first command that God gives human beings is in number 6, and God blessed them, and God told them, bear fruit and multiply and fill the land to produce life. Yes.
That's
a
very first, very
original
verse. Hard on people's hands.
Correct. Right, so Marlene points out that you're talking about this command, which seems insensitive to the fact that not everybody's able to produce children, whether because they don't have a mate or whether because science isn't able to help them, medicine isn't able to help them. There are all sorts of reasons why somebody might not be able to have children. So it's very interesting. There's a passage in the Talmud in Shabbat which talks about the 6 questions that we are asked in the next world. After a person leaves this world, they're asked 6 questions. It's great. In school, we always wanted the questions in advance. So the Talmud actually gives the questions in advance. Anybody know what the first question is? Read this before? The first question is, Nasata benatata be'emuna. Did you deal with others honestly? That's question number 1. Question number 2 is, Kavata itin la Torah. Did you set time to study Torah? Not just did you learn, but did you have a particular time, I don't know, 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, but did you have a particular time that you designated as, this is time when I'm going to study Torah. And then the 3rd question is, Asakta Bepiria Verivia. Then the 4th one is, did you anticipate Mashiach? But the 3rd one is, were you osik? Hebrew speakers, what does the word la'asok mean?
Busy. To work at,
to busy yourself with. Good. Did you involve yourself with procreation? It's not, did you procreate, but did you try? And I think that's a Talmudic recognition that not everybody's going to be successful. Not everyone is going to end up with that. You know, some people may have the great fortune to be able to adopt, and that's a fulfillment of it as well. All of Judaism is based on an adoption, right? Which adoption am I talking about?
Moses.
Right? Moses was adopted. Without that, we don't get anywhere. He's still floating in the Nile. So, if someone, the Talmud is recognizing that ultimately not everybody can do this, and certainly not everybody can do it biologically, but the overall message that we're meant to emerge with from this is that God believes in generating life and in continuing to generate life, and we are designed to try to focus on how we can develop life. That's the idea. That's supposed to be a focus for my existence, is how can I generate more life? And so when you look at the issue of homosexuality, in which, yes, they are able to adopt and promote life in that way, but in terms of the union of the parties in the relationship, that focus is not on creating more life, because biologically that isn't going to be the result of their sexual act. Instead, it focuses on my relationship with the other, with my spouse. There's no focus on how can we, through this, create life. Yes, sorry. That's the argument, Judith. Right, but it's still the case. All true, but it's still the case. In other words, the biological act of a man mating with a man is never going to be able to generate life. There will be other ways that they can generate children. Right? Whether you're talking about surrogacy or cloning or anything else that's going to come down the pike. But insemination isn't going to do it. So that's the point of this. In other words, to say, this isn't a union which does that. If they want to have children, there are other ways to have children that don't rely on having the union. So the point is that's why this prohibition gets taken so seriously. Because you're talking about all the different elements that I put here on the board for how we grade prohibitions, but also because it goes back to the very purpose that's designated in the beginning of the Torah. Yeah, I brought for you in source number 7 from the Sefer HaChinuch, a work which tries to collect and explain a little bit about each of the Torah's mitzvot. So mitzvah number 209, he writes in source number 7, among the roots of this mitzvah is this: God wishes the world he created to be settled. Therefore he commanded that they not waste seed in homosexual relations. He's very clear about what it is that bothers him about it. He doesn't say that people are deviant. He doesn't say that people are terrible human beings. That's not his point. His point is that this is a relationship that in and of itself is not a reproductive relationship. And I should note, he also weighs in that same section, against a relationship which is set up initially in which one partner is able to procreate and the other one is not. He talks about a man who is no longer able to have children marrying a much younger woman. And he's just as disapproving of what's happening there. Yes? Well, we know what he'll say about birth control. Birth control in Judaism, in Orthodoxy certainly, is a controversial topic. There are cases where it's justified. Most classically, historically, where there would be a threat to the health of the mother if she were to become pregnant. But there's a lot of discussion about it. Methods of birth control, when is it appropriate, how long is it appropriate for. This is all part of the same conversation. Absolutely correct that that's part of this. Yeah?
That would also be masturbation.
Oh, yeah. That'll be part of this also. Yeah. So in terms of this, that's a second dimension to this. Part of it is the nature of the prohibition, part of it is the substance of the issue, and then there is the magic word, Toheva. What do we do with this word toeva? So the problem with the word toeva is that it doesn't admit of a simple translation. What's the normal translation for toeva? You've all heard it. Abomination. Right? Abomination. King James tells us that it is an abomination. So the truth of the matter is abomination is not a Hebrew word. It's a word that carries great emotional weight for people, but it's not our translation. It was foisted upon us, and it's become the symbol of a whole lot of hatred. What, in fact, does the word toeva mean? That's very difficult. If you look in the Torah, you will find the following prohibitions, all of which are labeled toeva, just in the Chumash. Idolatry, non-kosher food, an inappropriate karban offering to God, cross-dressing. Sorry, it's true. Remarriage of one's divorced spouse after they marry somebody else. Dishonest weights and measures. That's your list. Toeva is that which you reject. Now, I like the idea that dishonest weights and measures are considered an abomination. There's something to be said for that, for being dishonest in business. But the point is that the word toeva is not an easy word to translate. It's the sort of word which has technical application biblically and doesn't necessarily translate easily into English, because you'd have to find a common denominator in all of those things, which also doesn't include all the things that aren't called toeva. Like, can you find a category that somehow all of these things fit? It's really hard. If you take a look at source number 8, you'll see my Hebrew source here. The Hebrew readers will get it. I'll explain it, obviously, for everybody else. In the Talmud here, one of the sages is translating different odd words that appear in the Torah. And one of them is the word toeva. And he says it's a contraction of sorts. The word is toe ata ba. Toeva, toe ata ba. Toe with a tav, not with a letter tet. Toe with a taf. With a letter tet, it means to make a mistake, but it's a different word. Similar, though. Toe with a taf is to wander. When Joseph goes looking for his brothers, and then ultimately they end up selling him, at some point he starts wandering in a field, and it's described as being toe basadeh. Toe ataba means you are wandering, you are straying with this. That's the meaning of toeva. It is a straying. Straying from, yes, what the Torah would normally prescribe. Take a look at number 9. It is the classic commentary of early sages, you're talking about 13th, 14th century, on that passage in the Talmud. And it says, you wander in it, meaning abandoning lying with a woman to go to a man. Abandoning heterosexuality for homosexuality. There are those who read it as abandoning one's wife, and they say that maybe this is also a problem specifically because of concern for men leaving marriages for this. It's an interesting read. I don't think it's correct, though. The key point, though, emerges in source number 10, an article that appeared in the journal Tradition. You can see there the attribution of Joel Olowelski or Bernard Weinstein. They're dealing with the question of how one offers counseling for a male Orthodox adolescent homosexual. So they write, as part of their essay, it is interesting to speculate why the Torah stresses that homosexual acts are, quote, an abomination, along with other prohibited abominable sexual acts, just as it labels unkosher food abominations, right, like we just pointed out. But that is neither here nor there. The Torah forbids these because they are quite normal, but in the Torah's view, improper. Sometimes we can understand the reason for a prohibition. Indeed, the argument against homosexuality is as cogent as that in support of kashrut. For kashrut being maybe a topic for another time, as we said. But whether or not we understand the rationale of a specific prohibition, we can assume that any Torah prohibition implies that it is something which is part of a common human situation that is being prohibited. Again, the person who's doing this, the person who's drawn to this, is not crazy, is not deviant, is not evil. This is a desire, and the Torah is saying, we don't want you to act on it. Why? Because it's not a procreative relationship, is the read that we've seen. So, That, I hope, addresses some of the question of why people take this so seriously. Why does this get blown up beyond other rules within the Torah? Marjorie?
Well, but what about transgender?
That's a whole other discussion, which I'm glad to have. But it will take you further afield because that employs other questions, which admittedly are related. Like the question of, if someone is able to procreate, are they allowed to do things to their body that will prevent them from being able to do so? Right? That's a classic consideration. The issue of cross-dressing becomes part of that as well. The question of, does Jewish law recognize the effect of transgender surgery? So that they would then do the mitzvot of and be subject to the rules of whatever gender they transfer to.
But what if they don't have the operation?
Yeah.
But are transgendered outwardly, physically, they look the other sex.
Right, because of hormone treatment or exactly. The way they dress or whatever it is. Right, that's all part of this very interesting question.
Is that an abomination?
So the cross-dressing was on the list of Toeva. Again, I really don't like using the word abomination because it's not our word, it's not our tradition, and it just has all sorts of baggage that that I don't think is helpful for us. So I'm going to... But yes, the cross-dressing issue was one of those that that carried the word Toeva on it. Yes?
If women repent, is that
cross-dressing? No. That was an easy one. And also not member earrings. In our society, these garments do not mark a man or a woman. The garments are common to both. Whether something is a good idea and whether something has other laws associated with it is a separate question. Meaning there are separate issues of how one dresses beyond cross-dressing. So I'm not going into the broader questions of Orthodox dress codes. Yes?
Is the implication then that people who cannot express their homosexuality, they should marry and have children?
Absolutely not. So hang in there, because that will take us to, not this next question, but the one after it. So what exactly are we expecting of people who are in this position? I'm just looking at the time and realizing that we're getting late, so I want to make sure to come back to this quick question, and then, yeah.
Just a little bit of pop culture. I mean, years ago, like Elizabeth Taylor committed to Eva when she married Richard Burton a second time in between marriages. Correct?
I really don't want to talk about individuals. Okay. So the next question we have to ask goes back to the question that was asked before of, is this biological? What causes this? So scientists are agreed that there are a range of causes for this, meaning that there is a belief in many scientific circles, again, not universal, that elements of the brain may actually push someone in the direction of being homosexual. They talk about the hypothalamus. There's all sorts of discussion of what it might involve. But there is an idea that it may, in fact, be biological. However, that's not true for all people who are homosexual. There are also young men and women who are experimenting and deciding, you know, I'd like to see. There are people who opt for this because of a particular person. There's somebody personally to whom they're attracted, and it isn't even about the gender as a whole. There are people who may have an event in their life that scares them off of the gender. It can happen as a response to rape. It can happen as a response to abuse. There are all sorts of reasons why somebody might go in this direction. One reason, though, may well be biological. And so that leads to the question, if that's true, is God cruel enough to put somebody in a position where their sexual fulfillment, and not just sexual fulfillment, but their relationship fulfillment, is contingent on violating this law that we've said is very significant and is very serious? Can God really do that to people? So I want to note first one point which is important to be aware of just sociologically. The term homosexual does not mean incapable of being attracted to the opposite gender. That's not what the word means. You're familiar, I assume, with the Kinsey study from 1948, right? Behavior of the human male. So Kinsey comes up with a scale, the Kinsey scale, of 0 to 6. From 100% heterosexual to 100% homosexual. And the idea is that it's a spectrum. And many people will be somewhere along the spectrum with desires that could go in both directions. They're not all one way. They're not all another way. In fact, there was a British study. Oh, I brought it on here. Source number 11. Take a look at this. With each generation, people see their sexuality as less fixed in stone. The results for 18 to 24-year-olds are particularly striking. This is 2015. As 43% place themselves in the non-binary area, meaning neither all one way nor all the other way, between 1 and 5, 52% place themselves at one end or the other. Of these, of the 52, only 46% say they are completely heterosexual and 6% as completely homosexual. So 52% of people admit saying, you know what, I'm not all one way, I'm not all the other way, I'm somewhere in between. Now, that doesn't mean that there's nobody who's all one way, but it means that you have to recognize that this is actually something quite fluid. I read a book by a fellow named Eric Marcus called Is It a Choice? And it's a collection of questions, popular questions that people ask regarding homosexuality and the answers that he gives. And he says, from his experience, not personally, his experience personally and in his community, that no, a male can be homosexual and can also be attracted to women. My point is not to say that therefore people should be forced into relationships that they don't want. That's not at all what I'm suggesting. What I am suggesting is that biological preference for one gender does not necessarily rule out a relationship with the other gender. That's one point. Karen?
But it seems that that's, even if there are, how many are, sure, not everybody is gay, but even if there are some, then really that's just a bunch, I think that that's just coding it and making it, that if there is biological reason, then...
But it's a question regarding those. No, that's absolutely true, but I think it's important to recognize that what you're talking about is not the that everybody who is gay is now being told this. Recognizing that there is a population which we still have to address for whom this is an issue, but gay is not the same thing as saying incapable of having a relationship with the opposite gender. But let's say we are talking about that. Let's say we're talking about that smaller number, but that group that can't have a relationship with the opposite with that opposite gender. So some actually make the argument that this is what is called in Hebrew ones. Anyone familiar with the word ones? So ones, as it's used, I heard somebody say it in the original biblical context, is a term for rape. That's the original use of the term.
Rape?
Yeah. But the way that it's used is not rape specific. It's understood to mean compulsion. Well, rape is compulsion. It's not the only case of compulsion. There are other events that happen in a person's life that can involve compulsion. And the point is that there are those who make the argument, most notably Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the former chancellor of Yeshiva University, made this point in an article in the Encyclopedia Judaica yearbook in 1974 called Judaism and the Modern Attitude to Homosexuality, suggested that if somebody is in a situation in which, no, they can't have a relationship with anybody else, we would view what they are doing as the result of being compelled. And that would then reduce their liability, because if I'm compelled to do something, then I'm not liable for what I did. So that was one potential argument that was brought. But even without that exemption, the fact of the matter is that God well may give a person a desire, even such a dominant desire, for something that is prohibited. Our task is not to succeed. Our task is to do the best that we can do. You know, Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler was the head of the major yeshiva in Gateshead, England, during World War II. You may have seen a book he authored. It's translated into English under the title Strive for Truth. And he spoke about the concept of free will within Judaism. The idea that we have the ability to decide what we're going to do. And he said, free will on many issues is actually a delusion. He gave an analogy which I'm going to give an analogy for further, to what I will call a football field, a soccer field, whatever you like. On a football field, you have two ends, they're called the end zones. And then you have the middle area. The job of one team is to go this way, the job of the other team is to take the ball that way. Let's say this end zone is that of sin. And this end zone is that of mitzvah. Meaning, my job as a Jew is to try to go that way into the good things. However, something is drawing me to go this way. Rabbi Dassler's point is, based on biology and based on upbringing, bless you, there are things which aren't even part of the free will discussion, just because they're natural to us. People who are raised in a healthy, socially well-adjusted family are not going to steal and aren't attracted to stealing. Stealing is already in this mitzvah end zone. It's not a point of even free will. Technically, it's free will because there's getting in the store. They could shoplift and they could not shoplift, but it doesn't even dawn on them to do it. On the other hand, there are things that, unfortunately, most people do without even thinking twice about it. Gossip. Right? Gossip is, for many people, in the sin end zone, so to speak, meaning they're not even going to think twice. They just do it. And when you say, you know, that wasn't right, I had this happen the other day, driving on Bathurst. And car behind me pulls up in the right-hand turning lane, and then the light changes and goes zooming out in front, and then cuts somebody off and like nearly runs them off the road. Well, I took driver's ed in Manhattan, so I caught up with the guy, and I roll down my window, and I'm shocked to see that it's a guy I know from synagogue, and he has a kid in the car. And so I said to him, you gotta be careful, you nearly killed that guy back there. And he was I believe he was sincere. He did not even recognize what he was doing. Did not even recognize it, so I didn't even think about it. That's my 2-minute commercial for safe driving. Anyway, the point is that we have within our lives things which are things we don't think about, whether for bad or for good. And then we have things that move both ways in the course of a lifetime as we learn and grow and have experiences. Something may move into that area of free will and something may move out of that area of free will because we so train ourselves either to do or not do. So these end zones are constantly shifting. But the point that Rabbi Dassler made is that the main responsibility of the human being is to take care of these things that are in the middle, the things that are in your free will department. And yes, we like to move things out of the sin end zone in that direction. But the main point of free will, this, as he called it, the nitidanta bechira, the point where you can choose, is actually fairly limited. And I think that what you're talking about for people who are in this situation is something which for them doesn't involve, I'm now going beyond Rabbi Dassler, this next piece is not from what he wrote, but I think that that's very true when you're dealing with people who are in this situation. This isn't in their middle zone. I wouldn't necessarily go as far as Rabbi Dr. Lamb with his Onyx label of compulsion. But I think that certain acts aren't in your free will decision area. If you take a look at source number 12, I really like this passage from the Talmud. When God creates human beings, the Torah uses the word vayitzer at one point, which means that he created. And yotzer is a craftsman. So vayitzer, he created. However, if you catch the Hebrew there, you see the letter yud appears twice. It really should just be one yud. Vav yud zadi resh. But that second letter in the word seems to be superfluous. So the Talmud suggests it's a homiletic reading. It's not a literal reading. You're familiar with the word yetzer? Like yetzer tov, yetzer hara? It's one's natural inclination. And so it says that's why you have a second yud. There's a yetzer and then there's a yotzer. The yetzer is your inclination and the yotzer is your creator. And so the sage speaking, I think it was Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, says, woe to me from my nature, woe to me from my creator. Oili mi yitzri, oili mi yosri. So Sounds much better with the Hebrew. But what he's saying is, I find myself pitted in the sort of opposition where my Yetzer says do this, and my Yotzer, my creator, says do that. And that's a challenge in many arenas of life. And I think that's something that we recognize. The Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin put it most bluntly in source number 13. He was a Hasidish Rebbe who said many fascinating things. But he says it very bluntly. Sometimes a person will face a test which is so great that it's impossible for him not to sin. It is as the sages said, what could the boy do to avoid sinning? What he's talking about there is a passage in the Talmud regarding the golden calf. This incident in which God takes the Jews out to the wilderness. They spend 7 weeks on their way to Sinai. They receive the Torah in Sinai. Moses leaves. And then they spend 40 days without a leader standing and waiting in Sinai. And they have all this gold and no idea what to do with it. And as the Talmud says, putting this in the mouth of Moshe himself, defending the Jews to God, what in the world did you expect to have happen? Much as when you decided to make a really attractive fruit and put it on a tree in the middle of the garden, what did you think was going to happen? There is such a thing as a test that you can't pass. Now, I realize that's philosophically offensive to some people. I've heard people over and over again all my life say, God doesn't give you anything you can't bear, He doesn't give you a test you can't pass, and so on. But I'm in the camp of Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen. I simply don't think that it's true. I think there are things that a person can't. However, we never have the luxury of saying, well, this is the one that I can't pass.
Yeah.
Right? You don't have the ability to say, so I'm going to count this one, I'm going to discount that one. A person is responsible to do her best, to do his best, and that's true of anything in Judaism's expectations. But what I'm trying to get at here in this discussion is that I think it may well be biological. And I think there may well be people, men who cannot have a relationship with women, women who cannot have a relationship with men. And I think it's important to recognize that there is an understanding in Judaism that sometimes it's beyond a person. It doesn't make the person evil. It doesn't make the person horrible. They're dealing with something that is a tremendous, tremendous challenge. That's the way that I look at it. You know, if I had my druthers, you know, I would like to create a Torah in which, no, everybody is fully capable of fulfilling everything, and there's nothing that is beyond that is beyond a person. This bothers me. But fundamentally, my belief in Torah is that Torah is not going to conform to my sensibilities. So this is what I have. Now, we still have two more questions to get to. We have 8 minutes on my timer here. So I want to make sure to at least address this somewhat. So first of all, what does the Torah expect of a person who is attracted to this? As a general question, what does the Torah ever expect of a person who is attracted to something that they're not supposed to do, that the Torah says don't for? So here, first of all, I come back to the point that I made before. The person is not crazy, the person is not an abomination, the person is not defective. The person has to remember, Torah believes that all human beings are created in the image of God. And that very much includes this person who is dealing with this frightening and challenging situation and has to be respected for whatever it is that they accomplish. That's number one. Number two, he can be friends with men, she can be friends with women. What we're talking about is this particular, you know, sexual act that we're talking about. We're not saying that all their friendships are out. What the person should not do is to give up on their Judaism and on God. I brought you a letter here, which I'll explain outside of the text in number 14. Maimonides wrote a letter to the Jews of Morocco. In his day, in the 12th century, the Jews of Morocco were living under a terrible persecution in which the Muslim authorities, I think it was the Almohads, decreed that you had to accept Islam. It was accept Islam, leave, or die. Those were your choices. Accepting Islam meant making a declaration that you believe in the Quran, you believe that Muhammad is the last prophet. That's what it meant. And someone whose name does not come to us through history, but some sage had written a letter to the community saying, you can't accept this. you have to die by the sword, and you don't have the option of pretending to be Muslim in order to get by. And Maimonides said that. And, oh, I'm sorry. The other thing he wrote, what the sage wrote, was that any mitzvot you do are not of interest to God. God doesn't want your prayers. He doesn't want your mitzvot. If you accept Islam, that's it. It's all over for you. And Maimonides writes this long, long, four-part rant against what this person had said, completely demolishing him in terms of his stance as an authority, in terms of his ideas, his scholarship. He takes it apart, like, beginning to end. That's kind of, it's too bad, we don't know who this was. But he completely demolishes the letter. And one of the points that he makes is that in Tanakh, as well as in Talmud, and in all of Jewish writing, we say that every mitzvah matters. Every good thing a person does, every time I fulfill what God has told me to do, it is significant and it is respected, regardless of the rest of my record. That doesn't mean I should say, well, I'll just do what I want that's bad, and then I can also do good things, right? That's the way we end up with people who will embezzle and then say, well, it's okay because I gave to Staka, right? That's not a good thing. However, the person's good deeds are always respected and valued and accepted. And that's the point that Maimonides wanted to make to them. What this person must not do also is to, if it's a male, marry a woman without telling her about his sexual preferences. That is horrible. It is obviously dishonest. It is unfair to her. I am aware that that such things have happened, and I think that's just wrong. You can't do that. If he's not going to be able to have the relationship that she deserves, he has to be forthright about it. Now, I do know of cases in which men and women have agreed to marry in this circumstance, knowing full well going in. That's their choice. But it has to be a choice that you make freely. It can't be a deception. One of the things that I don't encourage, and I recognize this is controversial, but I don't encourage conversion therapy. Right, the attempt by some psychologists to try to get people to go back to normal, so to speak. The horror stories involved in it are just too much. And I know that there are those who disagree with me, and that's fine, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's based on the evidence that I've seen. But what we expect of this person is to do the best that they can with what they have, and not to give up on their Judaism, their Jewish identity, whether in terms of this mitzvah or any other. Last point. What does the Torah expect of the Jewish community? So, I brought you here on the sheet in number 15. I'm going to say it outside, just looking at the time. The key challenge is this. Jews are commanded to be busybodies. We are commanded to prevent sin. We are. There's a biblical mitzvah which is called that you are supposed to instruct others. If you see the wrongdoing, you're supposed to get involved. Right? It's not my personal character. It's God told me to. So I'm a busybody. And we have all sorts of commandments that are related to that. The idea that all Jews are responsible for each other is part of this. We are guarantors for each other. We're supposed to look out and make sure things are right. At the same time, we are also commanded to protect people from harm and shame. I mentioned before the idea that we're all created in God's image, love your neighbor as yourself. We have a legal principle, which I brought you in source number 16, that human dignity is so important that it overrides all of rabbinic law. There's a very severe prohibition against embarrassing others in public. So I have a basic tension, right? I'm not supposed to let things slide. I'm supposed to instruct others when something is wrong. And at the same time, I'm supposed to respect and honor others. So what do? Well, there are grounds for leniency, to say we're not going to ostracize the person who is in this. We mentioned already the point about arguing that the person is being compelled and therefore should not be viewed as just a wanton sinner. There are other grounds for leniency on this. I'm just trying to figure out how to condense what I have to say on it. There is a principle which some wish to invoke, which I don't think really works, and that's called Tinok Shenishba. Is anyone familiar with that? Tinok Shenishba. It's a phrase that goes back to the Talmud. It deals with a case in which a child is taken captive. Unfortunately, a reality of the Roman period was that Jews could be taken captive and held for ransom, and it happened regularly. So if a Jewish child, was captured and in fact raised among non-Jews and never had a Jewish education, then he's not held responsible for the various violations of Jewish law because literally he didn't know any better. That's the rule of Tinok Sheni Shva. So there are those who want to make the argument that the person who has this homosexual desire is somehow in that category. I have a hard time applying that because they know full well that's not their problem. It's not that they don't know what Judaism has to say about it. It's that they have overriding concerns for themselves. I think that's a very hard argument. I think the more solid argument is what's called Mumar L'Te'avon. What does the phrase L'Te'avon mean? Bon appetit, right. But te'avon means hearty appetite. The word te'avon is appetite or desire. Not to be confused with the word ta'ava, they're spelled differently. But a mumar le'te'avon is somebody who breaks Jewish law, not because they reject Jewish law, and not out of animosity towards God, but rather because they really want something, right? It was one of the motive was one of the, or intention was one of the items that I had noted before. And Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Mishnah Brura, author of the Mishnah Brura, which is an authoritative work of Jewish law, says that if you're counting people for a minyan, and somebody who's there violates Jewish law, l'te'avon, out of desire, specifically, in the other words, he was walking past McDonald's and he just really had to have a cheeseburger and he was so driven by it that he did it, not because he rejected Jewish law, but this was just, it just pulled him. Don't ask me, I don't, you know, whatever, it's what I came up with offhand. The point is that doesn't disqualify him from the minyan. We don't ostracize a person for the fact that he was overcome by a desire in a particular case. It's not the same thing. So there are grounds for some degree of leniency if this is a person who fundamentally accepts Torah. Meaning Rabbi Moshe Feinstein dealt with a very interesting question, source number 17. It's also a common question in Jewish communities. If somebody doesn't believe in Torah, doesn't believe in it, can you give him an aliyah? Can you call him up to the Torah? And Rabbi Feinstein said, no. He said, look, the blessing on the Torah, thanks God, asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim v'natan lanu et Torato, who chose us from all the nations and gave us his Torah. If you don't believe it, then it's not a bracha. You didn't recite a blessing. We had an aliyah without somebody reciting a blessing. So he says, no, you don't call him up then. You know, they're not, presumably if they don't accept Torah, they're not all that interested anyway. Why are you forcing them to stand up there, reciting something they don't believe? So Rabbi Feinstein's point is, that's the test. The test is, can this person honestly say this blessing? Is that real for them? And if it is, then it's a blessing. In other words, what they've recited is valid. Their belief is valid. Now, where you get tricky is the question of impact on others. That's where things become more difficult. So if it's one thing to say, I have somebody who is gay in my synagogue and he can participate and be part of everything with everybody else. What if he walks into shul arm in arm with his partner? Right? Now what do we do? Because now it's a question not only of taking care of this person who is a part of the Jewish community, but it's also a question of validating what the person is doing. And that's where you're seeing a major split within the community, is this question of